This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Listening, restrictions on the killing of wolves.
And an environmental report released today names a southern Oregon river as one of the country's most endangered due to planned strip mining in the area.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 17th, 2013. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. In a press release earlier today, the Portland chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP, came out against the proposed fluoridation of our Bull Run water supply. The NAACP's position is significant, with the minority benefit framing by fluoride proponents and with voter pamphlets due in 2 weeks. KBOO's Joe Meyer has been following the fluoridation issue and has filed this report.
The Portland chapter of the NAACP is one of the oldest civil rights group in the nation and issued a press release earlier today opposing fluoridation of Portland's Bull Run water. The group listed lack of effectiveness, concern about health risks from the fluoridation chemicals, as well as harm to the environment in urging a no vote. I spoke with LCOD of the NAACP. It sounds like there's a lot of different opinions within the NAACP. Can you say more about the decision-making process?
The decision process, well, we make sure that we kind of read up on everything and make a decision. You know, it's not a one decision, it's about the whole entire group about decision.
Can you say then the official position of the NAACP on the issue of fluoridating Portland's water?
Well, on on Portland water right there is we came to the conclusion that we need more science. We need more science on it. But right now we're saying no.
What's the best news? What's the best thing coming down the pipe for the health of all children in Oregon?
Well, the best thing that's coming, I think the good old government is working on a good health bill to we can get that passed and legislation down there where all the kids and everybody can have health care and everything else for you in this country. And that's one of the biggest problem that we have in this country right here. We don't have adequate health care. And so we can get that right there. And then they've been working on that for 3 or 4 years or more. See? But, you know, it's one of the things that I like to see get done in this country right here.
That was LCOD from the Portland chapter of the NAACP. His group calls the water fluoridation scheme a distraction from the real problem of children's health. The NAACP encourages a no vote on the ballot and calls for alternatives to fluoridation, such as improved access to dentists and preventative care. And I'm Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
The Northwest Health Foundation donated $165,000 to Healthy Kids, Healthy Oregon as the battle over fluoridating Portland's water supply escalates in this last month before the May election. That donation is more sizable than either side of the debate has seen by a single donor thus far, and overall funds generated at roughly a 5-to-1 ratio as it compares to the opposition, represented by Clean Water Portland. Evan Mitchell, Portland campaign director, told the Oregonian she expects the bulk of the funds to go toward purchasing television and radio ads. Other large-scale contributors to the pro-fluoride camp include a variety of dental associations and Kaiser Permanente.
5 people were arrested today at a protest held at the Salem, Maine post office. The protest was held to raise awareness about the closing of the Salem mail sorting facility. The sorting facility will be closed this coming June. If the facility closes, Salem to Salem mail would be processed through Portland. About 50 protesters gathered at noon chanting, "Save Salem's mail or go to jail." Here's KBOO's Robin Ryan reporting on scene.
I attended a rally to save the distribution center in Salem from noon to 1 today. About 50 people gathered out front for about 20 minutes. They walked around to the back of the building, entered the loading dock, and have since been arrested about 5 people.
Also at the protest was Lewis Strack of the National Lawyers Guild, who was on scene to monitor police activity.
We started out in front of the post office on 25th Street here in Salem, and after a little bit of chanting and marching and waving signs and getting support, they moved around back of the loading dock, and evidently part of the loading dock here is a public area for bulk mail acceptance. So they continued to stage a protest back in that public area, but the stated intention of some of the protesters was to go inside the facility onto the post office property in order to get themselves arrested and gain publicity for the cause.
How many arrests have been made thus far? Do you know an official count?
There were originally 6 people who were going to go inside. 5 of them got inside and have since been arrested.
Were there police prior to the protest beginning?
There was one police car that showed up about the beginning of the protest just to keep an eye on things out front, but they were keeping a low profile until we moved around the back.
And one last question in regards to the arrested. Was there a reason given for their arrest?
Yeah, it looks like, again, we weren't allowed in back. They actually barricaded the doors, locked and bolted and barricaded the doors after those 5 went in, so we weren't back there and privy to it. But it looks like they were cited for trespass and then arrested and taken to the Marion County Jail.
Was anyone arrested while still on public property?
No. Those 5 were the only arrests. The police seem to have done an okay job by everybody here as far as that goes.
That was KBOO reporter Jemiah Sherry speaking with Lewis Strack of the National Lawyers Guild. Strack was in Salem today as a legal observer of the protest against the planned closure of the Salem mail sorting facility.
A river in southern Oregon is one of the nation's most endangered rivers, according to a report released today. American Rivers, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting rivers across the country, released a list highlighting 10 rivers in the United States that are facing immediate preventable threats. Topping the list was the Colorado River, which is threatened by excessive irrigation and outdated water management. The Rough and Ready and Bald Face Creeks in southern Oregon are also included in the report. For more, KBOO's Rebecca Ney spoke with Chad Woodward, the Southwest Oregon Outreach Coordinator for American Rivers.
Chad, can you tell me more about this report that was released today, maybe first from a broader scope, and then we'll zero in on what's happening here in Oregon?
The idea behind the report is not that it's the most polluted river, but it's a river with a real imminent threat. And the other side of the coin is there's actually an opportunity to do something about that threat in the upcoming year. And so those are the two criteria. And then moving into Oregon, this year, listed at number 8 on our most endangered rivers list is our 2 creeks. We have 2 adjacent creeks, Rough and Ready and Bald Face Creeks. Rough and Ready is a tributary to the Illinois River, which then again is a tributary of the Rogue River. Meanwhile, Baldface Creek is a tributary to the North Fork of the Smith, and the Smith is both in California and Oregon, their northernmost portion, and Baldface Creek in particular. And these creeks both have some outstanding values and the imminent threat of mining in each area.
Can you elaborate more on these threats?
Rough and Ready Creek has had a number of mineral claims in the past, and those are forthcoming again, some of those areas that have had claims. And the claims are for nickel laterite, and that is a component used in making, I believe, stainless steel. And similarly, nickel laterite is also found over in the Baldface Creek area. And there's a new effort by an international company who's looking to mine and actually, they are looking to do 59 test sites, drilling on 59 test sites in the very near term, this spring or perhaps summer, to determine the valuation of the nickel laterite in those areas. And, you know, that's just the first step to potentially wide-scale mining in the area.
What is your group calling for?
These areas, they are under the purview of the 1872 mining law. That law was obviously written a long time ago, and part of the intent behind that law was to help westward migration and exploration and settlement and extracting resources from these areas. Times have changed a bit, and the resources now that we get them from these areas that are so critical and important are the recreation, the spawning and rearing habitat for our salmon, and that has economic repercussions. And then there's the diverse botanical aspects and benefits from rough and ready. We're following the lead of our delegation here and think that they're asking for the right thing, that an administrative withdrawal would be a great way to start and have the United States Forest Service and the Department of Agriculture take that out from underneath the 1872 mining law, so that we can perhaps find a way to set that aside and use it for its highest and best values.
What can be done locally?
This concern has been brought to the attention of the United States Forest Service and the Rogue River Siskiyou Forest in particular for a number of years, and not just by conservation organizations, but Senators Wyden and Merkley more recently, and Congressman DeFazio, they've all been petitioning for an administrative withdrawal of mining rights in this area for some time. Please go to our website, AmericanRivers.org, and you can go there and sign a petition for this withdrawal. And by going on and signing this action alert, you can help us generate some support, and that will hopefully move the needle forward.
I've been speaking with Chad Woodward, the Southwest Oregon Outreach Coordinator for American Rivers, who just released a list highlighting 10 rivers in the United States that they consider the most endangered. One of those is here in Oregon. This is Rebecca Ney with KBOO News.
Yesterday, the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee heard testimony from supporters and opponents of House Bill 3452. State Senator Gil Hansel is a proponent.
Looking at this issue, and we are very optimistic that sides can come together and that we can have a meaningful bill that will help forward management. District 29 pretty much has all the wolf packs in Oregon within the framework of that and in Representative Jensen's district. It's a huge issue for livestock growers and the economy of this part of the state. Wolves are now a part of the landscape, and management is the key. Other states have effective wolf management plans and practices. This House bill provides, we feel, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the growers and others the tools needed to help manage wolves.
Animal rights advocate McKenna Grace Fisher voiced her concerns.
In our history in Oregon, Washington, California, and even the Rockies, we've had severe issues with complete dissemination of wolves where they've gone down to zero. My concern is that to accommodate ranchers, cattle raising people, that we constantly are killing off our wildlife to accommodate them so they can have their animals, you know, graze on grass and not have to fear that their livestock is going to be taken by wild animals. I want to make sure that there's a strong understanding and awareness that we have to take into consideration that wildlife is part of nature and it's part of what makes our earth and Oregon especially the great place that it is. We have to make sure that we do not go back to what happened in the late 1800s and 1900s where we wiped out everything. And if you think about it, back then there weren't the cattle ranchers that we have today. So for us to actually exterminate the wolf in that period of time, back in the late 1800s, it's very, very concerning that we could possibly mention that we will end up with poachers, which we already have an issue with as it is. So the oversight that we have to have, these amendments, which I'm not familiar with, we just have to make sure that the bill strongly emphasizes protection of our wolves and that we're not just handing out permits like they're doing in Idaho where there's wolf hunts constantly. I mean, all across the United States, we have a free-range ability to kill as many wolves as you want. That cannot happen here. We have to maintain integrity and a morality around what our wildlife means to us and to accommodate livestock, and I hate calling them that because they're animals to me. I just find it very concerning that we're going to lose control. And, you know, hunters are 6% of the population. And once they find out they can get a wolf tag, all bets are off. And we've seen this happen all across the United States.
If passed, the bill would change current laws to allow landowners to kill gray wolves without a permit if they are suspected of killing livestock or working dogs. Currently, the law only allows the killing if a wolf is caught in the act of attacking another animal. The gray wolf was once the subject of a state-supported poaching bounty until the population was thought to have been wiped out more than 60 years ago. The current wolf population is estimated to be between 40 to 50. The committee has a work session scheduled for tomorrow to further discuss the proposed bill.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Occupy Radio at 6, with a discussion of the Federal Reserve System, corporate command and control, and what you can do about it. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is mostly cloudy with a 50% chance of rain and a high temperature of 55 degrees Fahrenheit.
From these waters, thoughts for me to you. It's 5:19. Time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
There's a secret cosmic door that connects the parallel universes of Washington and Wall Street. It's not the proverbial revolving door, but a wide open passageway reserved for those in the know. Lanny Brewer is definitely in the know. He passed effortlessly from the job of defending Wall Street wrongdoers in cases before the Justice Department to then being the department's chief prosecutor of Wall Street wrongdoing. 4 years ago, he left Covington & Burling, the prestigious Washington law firm where he represented Wall Street clients, to head the criminal division of Justice. Dismissing criticism that his long service to Wall Street banksters created an inherent conflict with his new duty to the public, Brewer insisted that he'd be a better prosecutor, quote, because of my deep experience in the private sector. Yet, he did not bring even a single case against the Wall Street executives who've been publicly exposed as perpetrators of destructive financial crimes. Not one. Why? Call me cynical, but perhaps because he was using his 4 years at Justice to pad his resume and further enhance his value to Wall Street. No surprise, then, that Brewer has now passed back through that cosmic door, rejoining Covington in a specially created position to expand its role in defending corporate clients charged with foreign bribery, money laundering, securities fraud, and such. I'm a zealous advocate, said the guy who studiously refrained from being a zealous prosecutor. I look forward to being a zealous advocate for our clients again, he added. This is Jim Hightower saying, sheesh, couldn't he at least pretend to have some ethics? Instead, Lanny was relieved to be back on Wall Street's side. It's my professional home, he confessed. Oh, did I mention that Lanny's starting salary at Covington will be $4 million a year?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
In January 2014, a newer version of the General Educational Development Test, or GED, will be released that will not use pencil and paper format. The cost of the GED will also double, which has led to sticker shock for nonprofits and states. 40 U.S. states and Washington, D.C. are participating in a working group that is considering other GED options due to rising costs. The test revisions follow for-profit Pearson VUE Testing's acquisition and new joint ownership of GED testing service. KBOO Sequoia Wright spoke with Crystal Green for the Oregon State Department of Education about the continuation of the GED program in the state.
So based on what you know, Crystal, what are the chances of Oregon being a part of states that are dropping GED testing due to price spikes?
Well, Oregon law provides for a range of options for our students as they progress through high school and look toward higher education or workforce training. And the GED is one of the options that our students have had access to and will continue to have access to. Oregon's 16 to 18-year-olds can opt to stay in high school and pursue their GED through the GED option program. And students can also continue in high school after receiving their GED and go on to receive their high school diploma if they so choose. The idea is to make sure that there are options available to our students so that they can make the determination as to the best path for their future. And current changes to the GED exams will make them more rigorous, which is good for our students, and they'll be more closely aligned to the types of knowledge and skills that we want our students to have when they exit our high schools, so that they can be prepared when they go on to workforce training or higher education, so they can be prepared to be successful.
Does Oregon make the decision on whether or not they will continue on with GED testing, or is that a decision that's made outside of the state of Oregon of education from a private company? Or
sure. So I think it's a mix of both to some extent. I mean, we do have the GED option program. We do have ways in which this is integrated in with our schools. But the GED tests are run separately, and students would continue to have the option, even if we didn't have programs integrated through our schools, they would continue to have the option to approach testing locations for this, but I don't know of any changes to the current structure or process at this time.
Okay, and I've been speaking with Crystal Green for State Department of Education. Thank you very much, Crystal. I really do appreciate your commentary.
You're very welcome.
That was Crystal Green for the State Department of Education of Oregon speaking with KBOO Sequoia Wright. New York, Montana, and New Hampshire are switching to a high school equivalency exam. California officials are considering amending regulations to change the requirement that the state only use GED testing. Massachusetts, Maine, Indiana, and Iowa are making plans to investigate alternative exams. Tennessee and New Jersey are exploring offering more than one test.
Well-known environmental activist Daniel McGowan was imprisoned 4 years ago for arson, but confined to a communications management unit in spite of his low security clearance. He was denied contact with friends and family and has had his political speech severely limited. McGowan is now living in a halfway house in New York, but was jailed again as a result of an op-ed piece he wrote for the Huffington Post on April 1st. Although McGowan has been released, he is involved in a lawsuit, Arif v. Holder, which claims that his First Amendment rights have been repeatedly violated. For more on the story, KBOO's Jennifer Kemp spoke to attorney Alexei Agathopoulos of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
First of all, give us some background on who Daniel McGowan is. What are his political views and affiliations, and how did he end up in prison?
Sure. Well, Daniel McGowan is a longstanding environmental activist and an activist around a series of other social justice issues. Basically, Daniel was involved in activism in the Pacific Northwest and ultimately was arrested for some of his political activities and ultimately was convicted of his involvement in an arson that took place in which no one was harmed. So Daniel was sent to federal prison, but what was very odd about what happened to him was that he didn't get sent to a prison setting that correlated in any way with his security level or his disciplinary history. But what happened to him is he was sent to a small, an experimental prison unit called a communications management unit. There are two of these units. They were opened very quietly under the Bush administration, and they're highly unusual units in the sense that they impose drastic and permanent restrictions on a prisoner's ability to communicate with the outside world, so with family, with loved ones, and so on. Also, the number and frequency of your social visits are severely curtailed, as are your telephone calls home. So in other words, people are truly isolated at these units. And so Daniel was sent to one of them. He served 4 years at a CMU. Part of the issue at the CMUs, and this is what we're challenging in a federal lawsuit to which Daniel is a party, the case is called Arrest the Holder. We represent a group of prisoners at the CMUs who are, among other claims, bringing a due process challenge to the way in which people are designated to and retained at these units. Part of the issue is that there is no meaningful explanation of why you are singled out for the unit. There is no disclosure of the allegations that were used for the Federal Bureau of Prisons to determine that you should be sent to this unit. You don't get any kind of hearing or a meaningful opportunity to contest your placement in the unit. And then once you're there, there's no meaningful review process. So there's no real explanation given to what to do to earn your way out.
Recently, McGowan wrote an op-ed piece for the Huffington Post about being politically repressed. What were his main points in the op-ed piece, and what were the ramifications of him writing it?
Sure. Well, Daniel wrote an op-ed piece that was published in the Huffington Post to describe what had happened to him at the CMUs. There is a massive overrepresentation of Muslim prisoners at the CMUs, a tenfold overrepresentation, in fact. And there's also been a pattern of people being sent to the units in retaliation for their exercise of their freedom of speech. So Daniel falls into that category. Daniel was a very outspoken guy before he was sentenced to prison, but also he continued to speak out around a range of social justice issues while he was in prison. So he joined this lawsuit, and you know, we are in the process of litigating the case against the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And in the course of this litigation, we have received various documents that we had never seen before, and in fact, no one outside the BOP had ever seen before, that listed some of the reasons that Daniel was sent to the CMU and kept at the CMU, and they're really pretty astonishing. And this is what he wrote about in his article, now that he's out of the CMU. He's at a halfway house here in New York. So these memos that we got talk about Daniel's attempt to unite environmental and animal liberation movements. They cite to the fact that, and this is a quote, he has been publishing his points of view on the Internet in an attempt to act as a spokesperson for the movement. So this goes on and on. Now, of course, this is core protected political speech. It is absolutely a fundamental premise of the First Amendment that you be allowed to express your political views. And yet what we're seeing here are these memoranda written by the federal government using this political speech as exactly their rationale for keeping Daniel at the CMUs and sending him there to begin with. So Daniel wrote this blog just a couple of weeks ago that was published on the Huffington Post. So it was published on April 1st. 2 days later, he was not issued a daily work pass to go to his current job. He works at a law firm, and he resides at a halfway house. On April 4th, the U.S. Marshals showed up at his halfway house and took him into custody. He was taken to the Metropolitan Detention Center, which is the federal jail in Brooklyn. And he was placed in the special housing unit, which is basically the solitary confinement unit at the jail. So we immediately alerted the Department of Justice that he was in custody in apparent retaliation for his article. And indeed, he was released from jail the next day.
This is Jennifer Kemp with KBOO News.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled against a suit brought by Esther Kobel against the Shell Oil Company. Kobel, a Nigerian citizen, is suing the corporation for its complicity with the Nigerian government in killing her husband and 10 other activists. Although the murder did not happen on U.S. soil, Kobel referred to the precedent of Alien Tort Statute, or ATS, dating back to 1789. The ATS allows violations of international law to be tried in U.S. courts. The law has been used in over 100 cases, including a suit brought against the Chiquita Banana Company by survivors of massacres of thousands by Colombian paramilitary fighters working with Chiquita. Because the Supreme Court overruled Kobel, the statute now only applies to U.S. citizens and entities, whereas before it applied to all offenders. According to Judge Stephen Breyer, Shell does not qualify as a U.S. entity because their only headquarters in the United States is a small office in New York City to meet with potential investors. Not only will there be no repercussions for the killing of Coble's husband from this lawsuit, but similar international cases will have the recourse of the ATS to appeal.
Despite early reports, authorities now say they do not have a suspect in custody for the Boston Marathon bombing. Also, contrary to previous reports, no suspect has been identified in surveillance videos. Some news outlets reported that a Saudi national was identified and arrested in connection with the bombings. Munir Awad, executive director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations in New York City, said, quote, "Americans have been conditioned to assume that any act of terror on our land has been perpetrated by a Muslim." Awad said that many in his community are, quote, "holding their breath in fear of backlash that has continued since the 9/11 attacks." Boston's largest mosque, the Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center, has been asked to guard its campus, according to the Huffington Post. Awad cited conservative columnist and Fox News contributor Eric Rush, who today tweeted, "Muslims are evil, let's kill them all," after the attacks. Rush later said that he was being sarcastic. The FBI and Boston police are combing surveillance footage and the scene of the bombing for clues as to who is responsible.
Four blasts in and near Baghdad killed at least three people and left 16 wounded today, according to police. Iraq's provincial elections are scheduled for Saturday, and violence has been escalating in the lead-up. An Iraqi army convoy was struck with a car bomb, and a roadside bomb hit a politician's convoy. The U.S. Embassy in Baghdad condemned the violence with a written statement yesterday, calling the attacks, many of which targeted some of the politicians themselves, quote, "cowardly and unacceptable," unquote.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, at least 24 people were killed today and yesterday in five separate attacks across Afghanistan. With the spring fighting season underway, April has been the deadliest month this year already for civilians and soldiers. As of today, 182 people have been killed. Seven civilians, including women and children, were killed in Herat province when their truck hit a roadside bomb. Five government security officers were also killed by a roadside bomb in eastern Afghanistan. Taliban insurgents attacked a checkpoint in eastern Afghanistan, killing four village policemen. Insurgents also opened fire on town elders in northern Afghanistan, killing two health workers.